Hello and welcome to the Theotivity Podcast. My name is Thaddeus and I'm glad that you've joined me for this episode of the podcast. We're continuing in our series on eschatology, taking a look specifically at Matthew 24. Now, if you've missed the previous episodes, I definitely recommend strongly that you go back and listen to them. In our first episode, we looked at what Jesus meant when he said that all these things would take place before this generation passed away. We saw that clearly Jesus meant that the generation in his day would see the fulfillment of his predictions in Matthew 24. We also saw in our second episode in this series that the coming, which he spoke about, was not the coming of his final, second coming, right, at the consummation of time, but rather his coming in judgment upon the unbelieving Jews in Jerusalem, which signaled the end of the Old Covenant age. So therefore, his predictions in Matthew 24 deal not with the end of the temporal world, but rather the end of the Jewish age of redemptive history with its temple and sacrificial system. His answer to the disciples' first question of when these things would take place was that they would happen within a generation or 40 years of their time. Now, again, if you've not listened to the previous two episodes, I strongly recommend going back and listening to them, or you can read the article versions on the website before you continue in this series, because it's going to keep building on each other. In this episode, we're going to begin to examine his answer, Jesus' answer to the disciples' second question. The second question was, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Were these signs meant for the disciples in his day or for a future fulfillment? We've already seen that Jesus' word clearly implies that he meant that they would be fulfilled within a generation of his day. So therefore, if his predictions did not actually come true, then Jesus is a false prophet. Indeed, this has been the contention of atheists such as Bertrand Russell. So we have to examine if they were actually fulfilled in the first century or not.
The Theotivity Podcast. Theotivity is the place where theology and creativity come together. Here you'll find audio narration of articles, episodes exploring the faith, culture, the arts and media, systematic theology, apologetics, guest interviews with Christian thinkers, creatives, pastors, theologians, and much more. At theotivity.com, you'll find articles and resources to help you grow in your faith, as well as a portfolio of creative works. Like, share, and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest content.
All right, so let's begin by reading the passage. Matthew 24, I'm going to read verses 3 to 14. I'm reading from the ESV. It says this: As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginnings of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my namesake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." All right, so as we continue on, I need to talk a little bit about the testimony of Josephus. If you've been around Christian apologetics for any period of time, you probably have heard that name before, Josephus. And Josephus's testimony will be very important in these episodes, among other sources that I'll be citing, since he was not a Christian. So he was not sympathetic to make up stories that would prove Jesus right. He was also an eyewitness to the events leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. You see, Josephus was a Jewish historian who lived in those times. And the records of his writings, in which he writes extensively of the events, actually remain fairly well preserved for us today. James Price, in his book, Interpreting the New Testament, he gives a pretty good summary of who Josephus was. He says this, quote, "Josephus was born at Jerusalem in around 37 to 38, the first year of the emperor Caligula's reign. The time of his death is not known, but he outlived Herod Agrippa, for Josephus records the latter's death in AD 100. Josephus was the son of a priest. He claimed descent from the Hasmoneans. As a young man, he was attracted by the teachings of various parties and sects in Palestine, but eventually he joined the popular party, the Pharisees. During the procuratorship of Felix, Josephus went to Rome to obtain the release of some arrested priests. Shortly after his return, the Jewish war began. Perhaps the impressions of Roman power which he had gained led Josephus to attempt to thwart the foolish rebellion in Palestine. But he was swept into the maelstrom as a partisan and for a time held a position of military leadership in Galilee. After the Roman victories in this region and his arrest, Josephus sought to mediate between the warring groups. It was not a popular position, for he was suspected by the Romans and hated by the Jews. He was able, nonetheless, to observe much of the war at first hand. Afterwards, he witnessed the triumphal procession of Titus at Rome. He lived there until his death in order to receive citizenship and various privileges, and to write his apologies. R.C. Sproul notes that Josephus's account of many preliminary events read like a chronicle of fulfilled biblical prophecy. He refers to the rise of false prophets in his second volume, a massacre in Jerusalem. He refers to the slaughter of Jews in Alexandria, the invasion of Galilee in volume 3. I've personally read, actually, large portions of William Whitson's translation of Josephus's complete works, and it is remarkable what he records and how it confirms in vivid detail what Christ has predicted. There are other important sources as well, such as the Roman historian Tacitus, who also lend credibility to the fulfillment of these events, which will also be cited in these episodes. William Wotton, in 1666 to 1727, he said and wrote of Josephus this way. He said, quote, "He is certainly an author very justly to be valued, notwithstanding all his faults. His history of the Jewish war is a noble demonstration of the truth of the Christian religion, by showing in the most lively manner how the prophecies of our blessed Lord concerning the destruction of Jerusalem were literally fulfilled in their fullest extent." You see, the difficulties that many evangelical Christians have today in seeing that Jesus' words in Matthew 24 have already been fulfilled is in part because they are unfamiliar with the historic sources that record their fulfillment. You see, many Christians today have never actually read Josephus' accounts. Many are bewildered looking forward to these events when they've already passed. However, Christians in the early church recognized the importance of the testimony of Josephus and others to these events which fulfilled Christ's words, and they actually used them as a powerful apologetic to the veracity of Jesus' predictions. Christians today need to recover this, since many fanciful interpretations of this passage, as found in popular contemporary end-time authors and preachers, have actually led to serious error and also to the ridicule of the faith. Now, let's take a look at what Jesus says about wars and rumors of wars in verse 6. One of the most popular phrases in this passage is what Jesus predicts about the disciples hearing of wars and rumors of wars. Modern-day interpreters will often point to various news reports of unrest in the Middle East or wars in Africa and other places as signs of the times. I'm sure you've heard of that, right? Somebody sees a news report and they're like, oh, signs of the times, man. Now, the popular End Times author Tim LaHaye wrote about living in the last days in the wake of World War I. He said that, quote, "There's no question that we are living in the last days. The fact that we are the generation that will be on earth when our Lord comes certainly should not depress us." And that's from his book, The Beginning of the End. More than a generation later, though, I guess Mr. LaHaye's prediction really didn't pan out. Yet, you know, somehow his books continued to sell. Let's talk a little bit, take a break and take a quick minute to talk about the Pax Romana, because that's a really important thing to know about the historical context. So today, extremist groups like ISIS and the Taliban, as well as international tensions between nations, it's not uncommon to hear of wars, right? So it seems like an odd prediction, if it was meant for our times anyways, to say that hearing of rumors of wars would be a sign that the end was near. These days, it's actually fairly commonplace with our internet-enabled, media-saturated, instant reporting culture to hear of wars. However, this was not the case in the first century. we have to remember the context of the New Testament. It was based in a time and place where the people enjoyed what was commonly known as the Pax Romana, right? Which means the peace of Rome. Rome had conquered the majority of the known world to them. And with its conquest and having subdued most of her enemies, the people under Roman rule enjoyed a period of relative peace that seemed like it would extend forever. Actually, Origen, who is in around AD 185 to 254, he speaks of the abundance of peace that began at the birth of Christ. That's in his letter to the Romans. Historian Borik observes that in the Roman Empire proper, this period of peace remained comparatively undisturbed until the time of Nero. And that's in Ricci's The New Testament Era. The Romans were quick to squash any insurrection or oppositions. And so, for the most part, the empire remained at peace. It was actually this relative peace and safety of travel which would help enable the spread of the gospel throughout the empire and the early apostolic church. It is in this context for Jesus to tell people that there was a time soon coming where there would be widespread unrest and wars. That would have seemed incredible to them. Yet this is exactly what happened. J. Stuart Russell comments concerning the years leading up to Jerusalem's fall this way. He says, quote, "In Alexandria, in Seleucia, in Syria, in Babylonia, there were violent tumults between the Jews and the Greeks, the Jews and the Syrians inhabiting the same cities. In the reign of Caligula, great apprehensions were entertained in Judea of war with the Romans, in consequence of that tyrant's proposal to place his statue in the temple. In the reign of the Emperor Claudius, around AD 41 to 54, there were four seasons of great scarcity. In the fourth year of his reign, the famine in Judea was so severe that the price of food became enormous and great numbers perished. Earthquakes occurred in each of the regions of in the reigns of Caligula and Claudius. Such calamities, the Lord gave his disciples to understand, would precede the end, but they were not its immediate antecedents. They were the beginning of the end, but the end is not yet." That's in Russell's book, The Parousia. Now, the Roman historian Tacitus, who lived around 56 to 120 AD, abouts, he writes of this period this way. He says, quote, "The history of which I'm entering is that of a period of rich in disasters, terrible with battles, torn by civil struggles, horrible even in peace. Four emperors fell by the sword. There were three civil wars, more foreign wars, and often both at the same time." That's in Tacitus's Histories, Volume 1. Additionally, in that time, there was growing violent Jewish rebel movement. They believed that they had to rise up and throw off the oppression of Rome on the Jewish people. However, many of their attempted rebellions were squashed by the Romans. Actually, Josephus tells of a day in which, quote, "The people of Caesarea had slain the Jews that were among them on the very same day and hour when the soldiers were slain," which one would think must have come to pass by the direct direction of Providence, insomuch that in 1 hour's time, above 20,000 Jews were killed, and all Caesarea was emptied of its Jewish inhabitants. That's in Josephus's Wars of the Jews in Volume 2. Now, the disruption of the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, by the Jewish War and the Roman Civil Wars occurred suddenly in a period of violent tumult when Rome went through four emperors. That's between AD 68 to 69. And the Roman historian comments that it was almost the end. That's Tacitus. So this period of history actually fits exactly what Jesus had predicted would come upon his first century hearers within their generation in Matthew 24. Now let's take a look at famines and pestilence and earthquakes. That's what Jesus predicts in verses 7 to 8. So another sign that Jesus says will signal the end of the Jewish age is that there will be famines. We actually don't even need to go outside of the Bible to see the fulfillment of this one. In Acts, Luke records that, quote, "In these days prophets came from Jerusalem to Antioch. Then one of them, named Agabus, stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout the world," which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar, Acts 11 verses 27 to 28. So here we have the prophet Agabus predicting and preparing the people for the coming famine in the land. Now, Josephus also confirms a famine in Jerusalem. He writes of Queen Helena's aid to the people. He says, quote, "Now her coming was of very great advantage to the people of Jerusalem, for whereas a famine did oppress them at that time, and many people died for want of what necessary to produce food withal, Queen Helena sent some of her servants to Alexandria to buy with money to buy a great quantity of corn, and others to Cyprus to bring a cargo of dried figs." That's in his book Antiquities. The early church historian Eusebius, he wrote this in around, you know, AD 260 to 340. That was when he lived. He wrote, quote, "Caius had held the power not quite 4 years when he was succeeded by the emperor Claudius. Under him, the world was visited with a famine, which writers that are entire strangers to our religion have recorded in their histories. And thus the prediction of Agabus recorded in Acts of the Apostles, Acts 11:28, according to which the whole world was to be visited by a famine, received its fulfillment." So there you see, Eusebius sees that as the fulfillment. That's in his book, Church History. Now, another one here, the Roman historian Tacitus, he writes this, quote, "Many prodigies occurred during the year. Ominous birds took their seat on the Capitol. Houses were overturned by repeated shocks of earthquake. And as the panic spread, the weak were trampled underfoot in the trepidation of the crowd. A shortage of corn, again, and the famine which resulted were construed as a supernatural warning." That's in Tacitus's The Annals of Imperial Rome. So with regards to pestilences, these things usually accompany periods of famine, and there are other records confirming this during the period. Another sign, in addition to the famine and pestilence, was the occurrence of earthquakes. That's Matthew 24:7. Now, I remember growing up in Trinidad, and anytime we would feel an earthquake, there would be certain people who would raise an eyebrow and comment on it being a sign that we were close to the end times. However, Jesus had a much sooner fulfillment in his mind. This period of the first century was actually filled with accounts of many significant earthquakes. J. Marcellus Kirk, he actually writes this, quote, in his book, An Eschatology of Victory. He says, "And as to earthquakes, many are mentioned by writers during a period just previous to AD 70. There were earthquakes in Crete, Smyrna, Miletus, Chios, Samos, Laodicea, Hierapolis, Colossae, Campania, Rome, and Judea. It is interesting to note that the city of Pompeii was much damaged by an earthquake occurring on February the 5th, 63 AD. Thus, the historical records of wars, famines, and earthquakes give evidence to what Jesus said were just the beginnings of the birth pains. The birthing, though, of what? As we argued in our first episode, it was the birth of a new age and the end of the old Jewish temple age. Anyone who has had a baby knows that the birth pains happen over a period of time and intensify just before birth. And this was exactly what we see happening in the historical record, and why it's such an apt metaphor for Jesus to use. Now, what about Jesus' predictions of persecution, betrayal, and martyrdom in verse 9? Well, persecution is another thing that futurists point to as a sign of the times. Whether it's a new legislation that discriminates against Christian beliefs, or more severe forms in countries, you know, where Christians are imprisoned or even executed for their faith, many today look at these tragedies and say, well, Jesus must be coming soon. How many times have you been in conversation with a fellow believer who looks at the decay of our culture and sees it as a sign that Jesus must be coming back sometime in our day? This is often accompanied by some sort of pious-sounding resignation of the culture to the flames, while Christians are to retreat and focus only on spiritual matters and hunker down until that rapture comes. However, this too can be seen as happening within the writing of the New Testament documents. Jesus said in verse 9 to the disciples that then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death. Notice who is the you that Jesus is speaking to. He's speaking to the disciples who were before him. His words were directed to them. To say that he was not speaking to them, but rather thousands of years past them, would be to make the text nonsensical, because it would be like you asking me a direct question, and then I answer you about something to be happening a millennia beyond your lifetime. Now, in the very beginning, Christians enjoyed relative peace, especially since the majority of early converts were Jews, and they were just seen as another Jewish sect by the Romans. However, this would soon change as their exclusive claims about Christ became more and more known. The book of Acts records these increasing instances of persecution, first from the Jews and later from the Romans. Many of Paul's letters talk about persecution and imprisonment, as do Peter, James, and Jude. Paul talks about being betrayed and being done much harm by people like Alexander the coppersmith. See 2 Timothy 4:14. In the years leading up to Jerusalem's fall, persecution and betrayal was something the early church experienced and would continue to suffer in increasing measures. Stephen was the first recorded martyr in Acts 7, which also records persecutions that broke out against the early Christian community, for example, in Acts 5 and Acts 8 and Acts 12. The apostle James was recorded as martyred in Acts 12 too, and Peter and Paul were martyred under Nero around AD 66. So again, this period fits exactly what Jesus had predicted would happen. How about his prediction of false prophets, apostasy, and wickedness in verses 10 to 13? We'll continue to comment more about Jesus' warning about false Christs from verses 4 to 5 in our next episode in this series. But regarding false prophets, J. Stuart Russell comments this way. He says, quote, "False Christs and false prophets began to make their appearance at a very early period in the Christian era and continued to infest the land down to the close of Jewish history. In the procuratorship of Pontius Pilate in around AD 36, one such appeared in Samaria and deluded many great multitudes. There was another in the procuratorship of Cuspius Fadus in AD 45. During the government of Felix, AD 53 to 60, Flavius Josephus tells us the country was full of robbers, magicians, false prophets, false messiahs, and imposters who deluded the people with promises of great events." Now, regarding the increase in wickedness and lawlessness, in Book 5, Josephus recounts his rebukes against the Jews for their sins. He said, quote, "Wherefore, I cannot but suppose that God is fled out of his sanctuary and stands on the side of those against whom you fight." That's in his Wars of the Jews volumes. He even echoed Jesus' words, maybe knowingly or unknowingly, and claimed that his own generation was more wicked than any other generation prior. With the rise of radical Jewish rebels, lawlessness was on the rapid increase in those days. Regarding apostasy, the New Testament attests that the church was being infiltrated by heresy from early on. Acts 15 records the Jerusalem Council having to render an authoritative ruling on issues of justification by faith because of false teaching about keeping ceremonial laws. Paul had to deal with this again later in his letter to the Galatians, warning strongly against the different gospel of the Judaizers. See Galatians 1, 6 to 9 and 2 verses 5 and also 11 to 21, and also in chapter 3 of Galatians, in chapter 5, the whole book of Galatians, right, is about this problem. Paul warned the elders at Ephesus to be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock, because fierce wolves would come and endanger the flock with false teaching. That's Acts 20. There were so many dangers of apostasy in the early church. Chilton, in his Paradise Restored, writes this. He says, "Some heretics taught that the final resurrection had already taken place, 2 Timothy 2:18, while others claimed that the resurrection was impossible, 1 Corinthians 15:12. Some taught strange doctrines of asceticism and angel worship, Colossians 2, right, and 1 Timothy 4, while others advocated all kinds of immorality and rebellion in the name of liberty, 2 Peter 2, Jude 4, and the rest of Jude, right? Again and again, the apostles found themselves issuing stern warnings against tolerating false teachers and false apostles. You can see Romans 16, 2 Corinthians 11, Philippians 3, 1 Timothy 1, 2 Timothy 4, right? For all these had been the cause of massive departures from the faith, and the extent of apostasy was increasing as the era progressed. You can see that in 1 Timothy 1, 19 to 20, and 6, 20 to 21, and 2 Timothy 2, verses 16 to 18, and 3, 1 to 9, right? One of the last letters of the New Testament, the book of Hebrews, was written to an entire Christian community on the very brink of wholesale abandonment of Christianity. The noted church historian, Philip Schaff, he commented on this period that, quote, "There is scarcely another period in history so full of vice, corruption, and disaster as the 6 years between the Neronian persecution and the destruction of Jerusalem." That's from his History of the Christian Church. volume 1. So therefore, we see that in the first century, leading up to Jerusalem's destruction, the Christian church was plagued with apostasy, heresy, increasing lawlessness and rebellion around them that threatened their faith. And this is just as Jesus had foretold them. In fact, most of the letters written to the churches in the New Testament have warnings and corrections concerning false teaching. Now, what about Jesus' prediction that the gospel will be proclaimed throughout the whole world in verse 14? The last sign that Jesus says will precede the end is that the gospel of the kingdom would be proclaimed throughout the whole world. Now, surely, this one could not have been fulfilled in the first century. None of the apostles reached the Americas, right? So surely this has to still be in the future, right? Well, not so fast. We got to consider, what does it actually say? Well, firstly, there's a translation issue here. The word in Matthew 24:14, translated as world, is not cosmos. As we saw in previous episode, where the disciples asked about, you know, the end of the age, aeon, not the end of the world, right? Here too, some translations render another word, oikoumene, erroneously as world, right? But what does this word oikoumene actually mean? The Greek English lexicon of the New Testament, based on semantic domains, which is Leonidas lexicon, it defines it this way, as the Roman Empire, including its inhabitants. In fact, the standard Greek lexicon BDAG, its entries for oikoumene include, quote, the earth as inhabited area, and the world as an administrative unit, the Roman Empire, among other similar shades of use. Now, and we see this usage clearly in Luke 2:1, where the Emperor Augustus ordered a census in the whole oikoumene, referring to the Roman Empire, not the entire globe. So therefore, when Jesus says that the gospel of the kingdom must go throughout the entire oikoumene, he means the entire Roman Empire. So, did this actually happen before AD 70? Yes, and it's actually recorded in the New Testament for us. David Chilton, in his book Paradise Restored, notes this. He says, quote, a few years before the destruction of Jerusalem, Paul wrote to the Christians in Colossae of, quote, the gospel which has come to you just as in all the world also. It is being constantly bearing fruit and increasing, Colossians 1, 5-6, and exhorted them not to depart from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, Colossians 1:23. To the church at Rome, Paul announced that your faith is being proclaimed throughout the whole world, Romans 1:8. For the voice of the gospel preachers has gone out into all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world, Romans 10:18. The book of Acts actually records the spread of the gospel from Jerusalem to Judea, to the areas of Samaria, and to the ends of the empire, just as Jesus commanded his disciples in Acts 1:8. Concerning the missionary exploits of the disciples and apostles, Lars Qualben, he writes this, quote, tradition assigns the following fields to the various apostles and evangelists. Andrew is said to have labored in Scythia, hence the Russians worship him as their apostle. Philip spent his last year in Hierapolis, in Phrygia. Bartholomew is said to have brought the gospel according to Matthew to India. The tradition concerning Matthew is rather confused. He is said to have preached to his own people and afterwards in foreign lands. James Alpheus is said to have worked in Egypt. Thaddeus is said to have been a missionary to Persia. Simon Zelotes has said to have worked in Egypt and in Britain, while another report connects him with Persian and Babylonia. The evangelist John Mark is said to have founded the church in Alexandria. That's the history of the Christian church by Lars Qualben. Thus, the disciples and the church fulfilled what Christ had said must take place before the end of the age in 70 AD. So we see that the signs in Matthew 24, verses 3 to 14, which Jesus said would precede the end of the age, were actually fulfilled leading up to Jerusalem's destruction. There were wars and unrest and famines and earthquake and persecution and betrayal and martyrdom, yet the gospel of the kingdom still spread throughout the whole Roman Empire. And this is an amazing testimony to the spirit-given resilience of the early church and Christ's promise that the gates of hell would not prevail against the church's advance in Matthew 16:18. It also shows that our Lord's predictions of what would happen in their generation really did come to pass because he is truly the Messiah who has inaugurated the new covenant and the kingdom of heaven. In our next episode in this series, we're going to take a look at the signs that Jesus speaks of in verses 15 to 28, such as the infamous abomination of desolation. And we're going to see if these were also fulfilled in the first century. So I hope that you've learned something here and I've given you some good food for thought. If I have, please share it with your friends and discuss. Until next time, Soli Deo Gloria.
Thanks for listening to the Theotivity Podcast. If you found this content helpful or edifying, please leave a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, follow us on social media and consider sharing this episode to help Theotivity reach others as well. Check out theotivity.com for resources, info on how to support, and subscribe to our monthly newsletter to stay up to date on all the latest content. Until next time, live and create to the glory of God.